This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thanks so much for joining us again. While we often lament the corruption and the collapse of Western culture, which has been exacerbated by the influence of cultural Marxism, but what is the way back? My next guest notes that the past can teach us a lot about the culture that we want to preserve and protect. And in fact, understanding our culture and its past, particularly through the arts, just might be key to defending our civilization. So joining me now is journalist, author, and screenwriter Michael Walsh. We're going to talk about his new book called The Fiery Angel, Art, Culture, Sex, Politics, and the Struggle for the Soul of the West. Michael, it's great to have you here. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Jenna. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I know we talked a few years ago about The Devil's Pleasure Palace, your previous book, great book. Now you say the necessity of restoring Western culture has only become more urgent since then. How has that been the case?
Well, I think we've seen the left and the atheist left, the cultural Marxist left, move the ball quite a ways from 3 years ago when Devil came out. For one thing, they've effectively tried to delegitimize Western culture by calling it racist and homophobic and intolerant and bigoted and appropriating. And, you know, they've applied so many negative adjectives to what we used to think was just our normal culture that it's clear that they want to take it down, which was the thesis of the Devil's Pleasure Palace. But now it's become quite obvious.
Right. Is that a sign of desperation or is that a sign of further deterioration, would you say?
No, I think it's a sign that they think they're winning. I don't think it's desperation at all. I think they think they've got us on the run, and the point of the Fiery Angel is to show them that they don't have us on the run. And furthermore, there are a lot more of us than there are of them, and we have at least 3,000 years of history on our side.
Absolutely. Now, when you see the language changing, you had mentioned all of these monikers, these insults that they hurl at us, racist, bigoted, homophobe, Islamophobe, whatever they want to say. Yet they come up with new terms or new rights, so-called, or new freedoms. You have the freedom from a hostile environment. Well, that was not traditionally what we understood freedom to mean as Americans, as outlined in our founding documents. How much has that changed the culture, just bringing in new ideas like that slowly and then a new generation of kids, for example, says, oh, yeah, I have the right to a safe space. How is that really changing our culture?
Well, it began, of course, with Franklin Roosevelt with his four freedoms where, you know, he had posited that we have freedom from hunger, freedom from want, whatever the four freedoms were. I don't have them in front of me.
Yeah.
And Barack Obama mentioned that at one point early in his either the campaign or the first administration, how the Constitution of the United States was a charter of negative liberties, what the government can't do to us. But what the left has always wanted is for there to be a charter of positive rights which enumerate exactly what we get to do. And, of course, they're the ones that are going to invent those rights. And that's what they've been doing very spiritedly for the last 75, 80 years, and especially recently, where there's every week, it seems, there's a new grievance group demanding new rights about something.
Right.
But to answer the basic question, the underlying question, they don't care what the Constitution says. They're beyond that now. I mean, I said, 10 or 15, 20 years ago that I never thought I'd see the day where the left would actually attack the Constitution, because they always used to hide behind it.
Yes.
Well, now they don't hide behind it. They like attacking it. And it's all part of critical theory, which is to question everything, attack everything, and destroy everything.
Yes, although with what would they replace it all? When you look at the left and you look at the cultural Marxists, they love to destroy, but what would they put in its place if they could get everything that they wanted?
Nothing. That's the answer. Nothing. They don't care. They're nihilists. You know, You think of the Big Lebowski, the wonderful Coen Brothers movie, where at one point the foreigners who are attacking the bowlers, or John Goodman, says, "You know, settle down, Donnie. They're nihilists." So that's what they are. They just want to wreck. They don't. they're like the Joker and Batman. I made this point in Devil's Pleasure Palace. You know, there are some people who just want to see the world burn, and that's them.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, isn't this a sign of what you mentioned in the book, this spiritual penury? I mean, this poverty that we're really suffering from in our culture.
Yeah, well, I think that moving religion out of the its central place in American and Western European life was the principal goal that they had, and they've accomplished that very well. And in my other home country of Ireland, they've just removed the constitutional proscription against abortion.
Yes,
in a not even close vote, basically 2-1 vote nationwide, and so that will now reduce Ireland to the status of every other country in the European Union, effectively. And they want an irreligious and agnostic, if not actually atheistic, society in which they can wreak their mischief.
Yeah, they sure do. It's depressing. So going back to the past is what your theme is here in the book, especially when we're looking at the arts. How is that a necessary part of restoring culture and getting Western civilization back?
Well, it's crucial because you have to know where you came from, as I say in the Fiery Angel, to know where you're going. And we have this very glorious history that goes back certainly to Plato and Aristotle and before them to Homer, and continues in our storytelling and philosophical and artistic traditions right up to today. So what they decided to do was, as part of their general animus against Western civilization, to cut us off from it and then delegitimize it. So if you don't know it, then you can't defend it. And then after a while, you're taught to hate it in the abstract. So this is why now we get the assault on the dead white males.
Yes.
Let's just be realistic here. The United States was overwhelmingly white and was throughout its entire history, not because of a plot, but because that's the way it evolved,
right,
in the same way that Europe evolved that way. There are different races, different ethnic groups all over the world, but for some reason now whiteness is now being demonized as well, because that's associated with Westernness, and they want to make sure that the Western countries are destroyed. So that's why all these attacks on what used to be unremarkable things are intensifying.
Yeah, well, they're screaming how evil being white is, even as they yell that we're racists. So I don't know how they're able to balance that when that's so contradictory.
Well, they don't really care about, you know, whether they contradict themselves or not. They just want to keep screaming. So we have to ignore the screaming, and then we have to fight back with the tools that we've been given. And this is what the Fiery Angel is all about. All the tools you need to fight back against these people are in there. And I hope in a non-didactic way, in an entertaining and interesting way, but linking up the Greek myths, for example, with the philosophy of Aristotle, with the history of Alexander the Great, with Thomas Aquinas, with Mozart and Bach and the development of polyphony, right up to present day with Dracula and Beauty and the Beast and these sort of timeless fairy tales that we all love. They're all part of a unity, a very cohesive unity, and that's what I'm trying to draw your attention to in The Fiery Angel.
Yeah, now you're talking about, for instance, the heroic narrative, the struggle between good and evil. Is that the tie that binds as you're going all the way back to the Greeks and moving forward in history?
Yes, because the thing that distinguishes Western civilization from others is the notion that, as I like to say, we're all the heroes of our own movie. We're not ants in an ant farm. We're not cogs in the wheel. And so that notion of the primacy of the individual and the importance of the individual has been with us from the beginning, from the Greeks. And if you go back to Sophocles Euripides and Aristophanes, you will see these fundamental tropes of Western civilization planted right there. And it should give you hope that you're not alone. I mean, the point is, the way you break anybody is to make him or her believe that they're alone, that no one else is going to come to their aid, that they have no leg to stand on, and that they might as well just give up and convert. Well, we don't want to, and we don't have to. And we have a culture that tells us exactly why it's dangerous to do that. And we just have to be back in touch with it.
No, you're so right. That's really a tool that the left likes to use. You're all by yourself. You're out of touch. You're out of the mainstream of history. And, you know, you want to be on the right side of history. Well, let's go back to history. We're going to take a break and come back with Michael Walsh. His book is called The Fiery Angel. Stay with us on Janet Meffer Today.
Meet Dan Steiner, president of Preborn.
Jill came into our center about 8 months ago. She was in a really difficult spot because her boyfriend was incarcerated. She didn't have a place to live. She's out on the street. She came into our center, and when she saw her baby on the ultrasound, she says, I've got to find a way to do this. She changed from abortion-minded to wanting to choose life for her baby, and that's where we came in. Coming beside that ultrasound with baby clothes, with housing for her. Her baby just delivered last Wednesday. It's a little boy. He's beautiful. That's the power of ultrasound. That's what your gift of $140 does. Five times, five free ultrasounds for women like Jill. Five babies born. Would you help us today?
80% of women choose life when they see their baby on ultrasound. For $140, you can help save five babies' lives. Dial #250, key word baby. That's #250 baby. Or to donate securely online, go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
We are back on Janet Meffer Today. Glad to have you here, and also glad to have with us Michael Walsh. His new book is called The Fiery Angel, Art, Culture, Sex, Politics, and the Struggle for the Soul of the West. And his previous book, such a great book, The Devil's Pleasure Palace, focused on the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, the cultural Marxists, and how they've been affecting our culture over these many years. And now it's about finding a way back. And I think this is so important, Michael. When you look, for example, at the fiery angel itself, Prokofiev's opera,
yes,
what does that speak to us about good and evil, the heroic narrative, and the power of the arts in restoring culture?
Well, I chose the title because of its resonance, and also because for a number of reasons, it matched up with my theory of obscure opera titles for titles of my own book, like The Devil's Pleasure Palace, which was an opera by the very youthful Franz Schubert. This was an opera by the mature Prokofiev that was not really performed in his lifetime and has only grudgingly found its way into the repertoire. It's a very strange piece. It's about a hysterical woman who may or may not be a prostitute who is locked up in an attic. And when the hero encounters her, because it's the only other room that he can stay in at the inn, she tells him the story of how she was seduced by a fiery angel named Mariel. And Mariel is, in fact, an angel that's mentioned in various books of necromancy and the occult. And she fell in love with the angel, and then he abandoned her. And so now she's kind of on this revenge mission. But I wanted to use the notion of the being on fire, which we have as a trope in Western civilization, specifically the phoenix, to link up all these ideas that I call the chain of cultural resonances. And one of them that I can explain very quickly is that the opening motif of Prokofiev's opera, The Fiery Angel, takes the notes from Stravinsky's ballet, The Firebird, which is about the phoenix, changes them. But they're recognizably the same notes. So Stravinsky's already linking himself up to Prokofiev's linking himself up to Stravinsky, and he's connecting the Fiery Angel with the phoenix, and the phoenix is the symbol of Alexandria, the city that Alexander the Great built in Egypt as his capital, and it's a symbol of the constant rebirth of Western civilization. So that's why I chose that for the iconographic image of this book.
Yeah, you know what really strikes me is how when you delve into the significance of what you just said and the ties between Stravinsky and Prokofiev, and then you compare it to the music that we're getting now, not from high culture, but from pop culture, vulgar rap and, you know, Kill the Police and whatever it is that's popular right now. It does matter, doesn't it, the sort of music that we're taking in?
Well, my feeling about pop music is it's ephemeral and it changes constantly, and it's not something we ought to get overly concerned about. Concert music was a very special thing. It lasted about a century and a half, I would say. It's now more of a museum thing than an active, ongoing art form, and whether that's good or bad, obviously I come down on the bad side. But I don't think we can compare rap, say, with Prokofiev. I mean, it's just, they literally are apples and oranges. But I think we do need to do, though, is look for the best popular art, which is what survives,
yes,
and then see what about it is resonating with the culture. What does it tell us about the culture that's producing it?
That's exactly what I was thinking, because in so much, and I'm not denigrating, I like some popular music, but I'm, you see in so much of what has been spewed out in the last 20 years, a certain amount of chaos and hopelessness and meaninglessness. And again, we're back to the quality of rage that so defines the left. I'm just angry and I'm going to pour out all my anger. You know, you go on your Kindle and you look at Amazon and you stream some of the free music, and I see explicit, explicit, explicit on so many of the albums. And I thought, that is a reflection of culture when you have that going on.
No, it definitely is, yeah. But I would say not to lose too much sleep about that. That comes and goes. And many of the terms that we apply to music we don't like were also applied to, for example, there's a whole chapter in this book about miraculous mandarins using the Bartok ballet for that. And boy, did that get ripped apart, as did Stravinsky, and in much the same terms that we use applied to rap music today. So it's always in the ear of the beholder, and popular music is a young person's game. And after a while, you just get too old for it, and then you just stop. It doesn't speak to you anymore. So
that's my attitude
towards that.
It's so true. Well, you mentioned somebody else who I just really love, Vladimir Horowitz, the famous pianist. And you write about, this is fascinating to me, because you cite his visit to the Soviet Union in 1986 and your coverage of that event and its significance. And I was wondering if you would share that story, because I do think that that shows a real powerful example of the arts over and against culture and speaking to culture. Can you talk about that event a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I was there for it. Obviously, I wrote the cover story in Time magazine that appeared in May of '86. It was an interesting time because during the 2 weeks that we were in the Soviet Union, the U.S. bombed Libya and Chernobyl blew up. So this all happened while we were there. So place it in that context, and also in the recent protests against the Pershing missiles in Europe, and, you know, Ronald Reagan was the cowboy, and, you know, the usual, same thing you hear today about Trump, you heard about Reagan. But what struck me particularly was the three performances that Horowitz gave, two in Moscow, one private, one public, and then one in Leningrad. They were just swarmed by people who just burst through the KGB lines. And as I say in the book, when I got to my seat in the balcony of the Tchaikovsky Hall there at the conservatory, there were three kids in my seat. So, I had to 86 a couple of them. But they did not want to miss the great man, but also what he represented, which was he had escaped the Soviet Union. He left. He emigrated secretly when he was a young man, and he held out hope and a promise for the future. And at that point, I just knew the Soviet Union was dead, and I came back from that, and the year previously in East Germany in '85, and I said to the managing editor at the time, this country's doomed, And I went on the radio in New York on the Lynn Samuel show, as a matter of fact, soon thereafter, and predicted that Germany would be reunited within 5 years. And, of course, I was way off because it was only two.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. But you could see the culture was overwhelming the enforced political false reality.
Wow.
And the Russian people rose up, and they used Horowitz partly as a battering ram against their own government.
Yeah, they sure did. I was there around that time, too, and I had that same thought. I didn't predict, but I said, wow, these people are not completely in line with the Soviet system anymore. They're really not.
No, they never were, and that's true even more so of the other Eastern European countries, the Czechs, the Hungarians. And I'm on my way to Hungary, as a matter of fact, in a week or so, and get a chance to see all the changes that have been made there over the last 40 years that I've been going to Hungary. I'm really looking forward to it.
So interesting. That should be a great trip. So when you're looking at art, again, we're talking about some of the music, but also painting and plays and all of the things that really, advance this heroic narrative. How is it that you connect our past to the hope of the future by which Americans now could seize on that past to turn the culture around against the cultural Marxists?
Well, compare it to if you had amnesia, that you were in an accident and you lost your memory, and then you'd be very disoriented and you wouldn't know anything. You wouldn't know your past, you wouldn't know where you're going, you wouldn't know where you live. That's what they've done to us. So once your memory comes back, you go, oh, this is my name, and this is my mom and dad, and these are my kids, and this is my house, and this is where my family came from, and I'm in Emporia, Kansas, instead of Seattle, Washington, or wherever I thought I went. You gradually begin to put your own sense of self back together.
Yeah.
And that's what we must do in the West. We have to reject both Islamism, which is a terrible, terrible threat
yes.
to everything
yes.
that Christianity and Judeo-Christianity holds dear, and cultural Marxism, which is an atheistic threat of almost the same caliber, and it hasn't been at it quite as long, but they're both at it together. So we need to remember who we are, and that's really all this book is a plea to help you remember by using things you already know, like Dracula, like Beauty and the Beast, like Stravinsky and Prokofiev, if you know classical music, or the Greek plays, or the Oresteia, or the Aeneid, or Roman history, or whatever it is that may tickle your fancy. I hope there's something in here for you that will be useful for you to go back to and read and listen and experience. There's also great works of painting cited in the book, and we spent the extra money to put reproductions of those pictures in the book so you can actually see them. And it's not just me talking about them. And whatever it is that intersects with your life, you can say, oh, yes, so that's what that meant.
Yeah.
It's not just an abstract one-off thing. It's a connective piece of the connective tissue from the Greeks to the present day. And that's really important to understand.
Well, it really is. Would you say that there is a most important next move to restore or to maintain Western civilization? Clearly, this is going back to the arts, but is there anything in particular that you think needs to happen to begin to turn the tide some more in the direction of recovering our past and the heroic narrative?
Yes, we have to stop being afraid of these people. They're not our friends. They're not nice people. They come like Satan in the guise of being friendly and kindly and trying to help us out of our own benightedness. But in fact, they're wicked, and we just have to put them in their place. One of the things that I admire about the president is he just calls it as he sees it, and it drives them absolutely nuts.
Yes.
And just, they're not used to being spoken to like that. Speak to them like that. It's the only language they understand.
Absolutely. And it would seem to go back to what really is good and what really is evil, because to some extent the left has enjoyed reversing that, or at least attempting to reverse that.
Well, that's true. I do cite the famous line, the devil's greatest trick is making us believe he doesn't exist, which it resonates throughout our poetic and movie history. So we have to pay attention to that. It's actually true.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, I think this is a wonderful prescription, and I'm all for it. I think that you really outlined some great stuff here for people to revisit. The Fiery Angel is the name of the book. Michael Walsh joining us. Michael, an honor. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right. God bless you. And we'll be back right after this.
This Janet Meffer Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org. Welcome back to Janet Meffer Today. Great to have you here. You might have heard this story out of Indiana recently in which a high school music teacher was forced to resign for refusing to call transgendered students by their new opposite sex names. And this is just the latest chaos to erupt out of the push to normalize transgenderism. But for those who have experienced transgenderism up close, there is an important story to tell about misplaced compassion and the greater damage that it can cause. And we're going to talk about that today with Denise Schick. She is the founder and executive director of Help for Families, a nonprofit Christian ministry helping people struggling with gender confusion and their families. She's out with a new book, It Is Well With My Soul, Finding God's Peace in the Transgender Storm. And Denise, it's great to have you here. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you so much, Janet.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I am curious to ask you what you make of these sorts of stories where increasingly you're seeing teachers in trouble because they won't use opposite sex names for, you know, the wrong sex, or you'll have these issues like that couple that lost custody of their daughter because they didn't want to put her through hormone therapy. I mean, what do you think about the insanity that has really ensued over this issue of transgenderism?
I feel like that I'm living on Mars.
Yeah,
you know,
me too.
That we are living in such an upside-down world where truth becomes something that is hated, something that people do not want to hear. And the fact of the wording, how it's changing, I mean, to speak truth or to act on how your conscience feels is right or wrong, and for people to be pushed into a jar, more or less, and have no way out. We're prosecuting people just on the fact of their moral values.
I know. It's just awful. And this is the way it's going. It's not so much that as they started out with this transgender rights movement, well, we just want to have rights. And increasingly, it's rights that they want that will encroach upon other people's freedoms. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on why this is being normalized. Why are people going along with it? And why are the activists pushing this so hard, do you think?
Well, I think that they are normalizing it by, again, you know, just what is truth, what isn't, what's behind the whole scene. You know, it's really about a spiritual battle that we're having here. People that believe in Jesus Christ, that believe in the Holy Scriptures and what they state, that's obsolete, you know, that no longer exists. And if you stand up for the truth, for Christian values, then it's as if that you automatically are known to hate others.
Yeah.
So, you know, to in a sense, with the gay marriage and where we're going with family and where I'm so saddened is to see children that have the rights over adults that should be helping to put some order into their world.
Yes. Well, that's right. And for those people who don't know much about you, Denise, I know we've talked before about your experience with your father, but briefly, can you share what your background is pertaining to transgenderism and what occurred in your family?
Yeah. My father had told me as a little girl, I was 9 years old, of his desire to become a woman. And so with that, struggling myself with my own identity by the time I was 11, because I thought if God did make a mistake and Dad should have been a woman, then how do I know that I really shouldn't be a man? And so starting to try to survive myself, you know, and trying to figure out my own identity. But with that, as I started to grow and mature into a young woman, there was a lot of emptiness that my father had for me. So growing up in the home environment was very difficult, to say the least, very confusing. And in fact, you know, when when I got to a certain age and he started to put on my clothing, to take my clothing into the weirdest places. And so I had no privacy as well in this craziness.
Wow.
But I understood even at 9 years old because my father had revealed to me that he had been sexually molested. And I knew that his mother was an alcoholic. And I also knew at 9 years old that he and his father did not connect. There was a very deep disconnect between him and his dad. So I understood there were other reasons that he may want to escape his true identity and who he was.
Wow, that's so awful. And of course, this was a time when you were a little girl that you didn't normally have people with gender dysphoria getting hormone treatments and sex change operations. That wasn't anything close to normal years ago. So how did his transgenderism manifest itself, his gender dysphoria? What sorts of things did your father do? As you mentioned, he wore some of your clothes, but did he act in a particularly different way when you left the house? Did he ever try to be a female? Or how did that manifest itself? What did it look like?
Yeah, he was doing it behind the scenes for many years, and I knew when he would be feeling that way because that was something else that he would say. For instance, for my father, he would say, you know, when I sit over there on the rocker and I cross my legs, you'll know that I'm feeling like a woman.
Wow.
And so he dropped all these hints to me, which were really, you know, they're life-altering, because some of them I could be in an airport and seeing a man and not saying that he's gender dysphoric, but because of these signs that my dad had told me, those words come just flooding back.
Yeah.
So it definitely impacts me even today, you know, with those memories. But for him, I was 28 when he had left my mom at that time to pursue the identity and to live under the name of Becky. And so he lived a transgender life for 13 years until he had passed away. But it was in those last few months of an illness where he actually, out of his own free will, nobody bullying him in any way or trying to make him feel guilty for what he had done. So out of his own free will, had said, this did not bring me the fulfillment that I thought that it would.
Oh, how tragic. That's hard. That's so hard. And I'm sure that he suffered it, given his background of sexual abuse. That's just, your heart goes out. But in your position as his daughter, how confusing that was for you. What sort of effect do you think that whole experience had on you as a little girl?
Well, I first, you know, had struggled with, where am I going to find a dad? Because dad doesn't want to be my dad in a sense. And so started to look at other neighborhood men or girlfriend, you know, fathers, go over to their house and in a sense have the imagination that they were my dad for the night. So I definitely had missed feeling that connection with my father, him in that role. I also had trouble trusting adults, trusting men. And that sometimes would lead me into, can I trust God? You know, if I can't trust my own dad, a sense of not feeling valued either, valued as a daughter, as a young girl. So there were many struggles. I ended up as a teenager saving up my lunch money, babysitting money, whatever I could get to go get drunk, to have something to help mask the pain.
Right, of course. What about your mom? How did your mom handle all those things, and how did she handle your dad's situation when it came to you? Was she a help? Did she talk to you about it, or what was that dynamic like?
Yeah, my mom, when my dad had told me, I did not say a word to my mom. She did not know until I was 28 years old of what he had told me. My mom struggled with migraines, severe migraines, and she got them a lot. And so as a child, I thought, if I let mom know that he told me this, I'm going to make her sick, you know, and it's just going to cause her more pain to know what he's revealed to me. So it wasn't until at that point where he made the announcement that he was leaving her to go and pursue this lifestyle. And at that time when he had finally left, though she knew that he was doing this behind the scenes as well and not really sharing that with any of us children, you know, a piece of her died. There was such a hope that I believe in her heart that he would get help, that he would stay in the marriage, that out of a marriage, you know, that their relationship, that they would grow old together. And so slowly, there was a piece of her that died and was never revived. She felt a lot of shame, a lot of embarrassment, even with her own family, when the news came out and the difficulty that was for her to share with her brothers and her sisters.
Oh, man. I mean, that had to be so hard for her and for you, even though you were grown at the time that your parents broke up. It's never easy, and especially seeing your parents break up for that reason. And I, you know, one of the things that you address in your book, and you really get into this, I want to talk to you about it, Denise, when we come back, is how to find God's peace in the transgender storm. We're going to come back talking about Denise Schick's book, It Is Well With My Soul. Stay with us. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
Cell Evolution. This is Ken Ham, a publisher of the award-winning family magazine, Answers. Even the so-called simplest cell is incredibly complex, but evolutionists must explain their origin somehow. Now, one common idea is that early simpler cells engulfed bacteria, and these bacteria didn't get consumed. Somehow, they started to serve a supportive role in the cell. Eventually, so the story goes, these bacteria evolved into today's complex cell structures. But these cell structures aren't just floating around in the cell. They're integrated with the cell's nucleus, which has all the information to produce the proteins these structures need. Without this information already in place, the structures would be worthless. Evolution stories can't explain this.
What else are you not being told? Discover answers to evolutionary claims at AnswersRadio.com and sign up for daily email insights from Ken Ham at AnswersRadio.com.
We are back on Janet Mefford Today. It's great to have you with us. Denise Schick is with us. She has a wonderful ministry. It is called Help for Families, the number four. It's a nonprofit Christian ministry that helps people who are struggling with gender confusion or families and people who are in communities affected by transgenderism and gender dysphoria. It's a very difficult topic. Denise lived this situation with her own father, and she's out with a new book called It Is Well With My Soul. Every Christian knows that hymn, Denise, It Is Well With My Soul. It was written under very trying circumstances by the hymn writer. Why go with that thought when you're discussing the issue of transgenderism and the hope that the Lord can bring?
You know, particularly for myself, because even though I've been doing ministry for 14 years and you're traveling and the different opportunities that the Lord has given me, there was still that part of me that's like, it still isn't well, Lord. And as I started to study more about the song, the hymn writer, the Stafford, Horatio, and what they had endured, and it was like, Lord, that, you know, that's what I want. I want to be able to say wholeheartedly, Lord, I didn't like what had happened, but I know without a doubt that you have made me whole, and it is really okay in my soul. I can say today that through the grieving, through all of the different feelings, the denial, the anger, the resentment, the ungodly heart attitude that I had, the difficulty of it all, that today I am really 100% can say to God, it is well with my soul.
Great.
I didn't like the lot that I've been given, but it's okay. It's really okay. And the whole idea of this book is to encourage others. Look, I know it's difficult. I know you may not be able to crawl out of bed the next morning, but with God's help, He will get you through this.
Yeah.
Right. And with his peace, we can have peace and joy again.
Well, and when you're talking with people who do have this gender dysphoria, is there any progress that can be made by speaking with them? In other words, people talk about this as being a mental condition. Can it be talked through? Can it be prayed through? How do you minister to people who have gender dysphoria?
You know, first of all, we listen. We listen to the circumstances of the situations of what they have faced. And we listen compassionately. But we meet them where they're at without apologizing for the scriptures as we start to show them the power of Jesus Christ. And many times it's unforgiveness in their own heart because of how they've been hurt, because of the injustice that's been done to them, especially as a child. And so as they start to untangle their past and to be able to come to that same place, in a sense, that family members that I am talking about saying, it is well with my soul, to know the wholeness of who they are in God and the identity that God has for them, the healing, it's not going to happen overnight, or I should say, you know, sure, it can with a miracle, but it's taken years for this type of identity to manifest. And so it's going to take time and dedication from that person to be able to address what they've been through in life.
Well, when you're talking about people who have gender dysphoria sometimes having unforgiveness in their own hearts because of their own pain, to somebody who's never experienced this condition, either personally or in their own families, it can sound like, how do you go from being in pain to wanting to dress like a woman as a man? What is the connection point between pain and transgenderism?
Well, you look for an escape of reality. You know, for instance, I was speaking with a young woman 2 nights ago, and she said, you know, when I was 6 years old, I was raped by my cousin. And I realized that I just wanted attention as I was growing up because she still she had the rape that she was trying to deal with, the embarrassment and the shame, but as well saying, I wanted attention. And so what we're working on now is we're going back, first of all, to the rape, to those feelings that had happened, and why was it so important for her to gain attention? So we have to understand each person, their circumstances, of where were the roots of this? What would cause somebody to want to flee, really, their true identity?
Right.
And to hide it and to mask it into something else.
What would you say, Denise, is the way that gender identity disorder ravages souls? Because that's something that you address in the book.
It steals the person's true identity. It takes the life away from them that God had fully intended for them, which many times is the happiness, obviously, for the person. So it steals everything that God had intended for that life,
right,
initially.
Right.
And Satan has taken it from them.
Now, for families, that's a trickier question, it would seem, in some ways, because they're dealing with somebody else's sin. I think you talk about that sometimes the trials you go through are because of somebody else's sin. Where do you begin to minister with families who say, like you did, my dad thinks he's a woman? Where do I even begin with this? And he doesn't want to get help. He wants to leave my mother. He wants to live life as a woman and maybe even have surgery. What in the world do I do? Denise, that's a tough situation to minister to somebody about. That's where do you even begin?
Yeah, you begin, and us as the church, to listen to the person, and many times to be there while they're grieving the losses, the shock that they're going through, to be able to comfort them through the words of God, to be able to minister to where they are at that time, and to be willing to walk with them through this process. Because if they just found out, and if the person is head-on and having the sex reassignment surgery and to live under that identity, there are so many rocks that they are going to be trying to climb up over and under to get on top again. The emotions that they go through, I think the worst part of it all is, honestly, Janet, is the grieving process, because it isn't something like a death, a natural death. We're speaking about grieving the death of somebody that we know, but there's no closure,
right,
because that person is still living.
Right. Now, for those Christian families who say, my transgender relative is not a Christian, how do I interact with my father? Do I call him mom? I mean, what about, how do you navigate those issues if you have a parent who says, I want to be called by a new name and those kinds of things? What do you advise people to do?
Well, I advise people to, first of all, to look at the scriptures of it, you know, and not to lie, not to deceive.
Right.
I never called my dad Becky, she, or her. And it was, I can honestly tell you, it was not out of a resentful, angry heart. It was out of a heart that just wanted her dad to know, to be reminded of who he was. Obviously, to, in most circumstances, to have a talk with a loved one and let them know, you know, if they're letting you know this in a conversation, I want you to call me, to be honest about where your personal convictions are. And the sense that, you know, this is where I am on this. And sometimes they're not going to accept it. And you've got to learn to be okay with that.
Right. Yeah, you talk in the book, too, about having a long, long-term perspective, an extra long in there. What are you talking about, Denise, when it comes to having a long, long-term perspective?
Well, a long-term, we can usually say when I get through this. But when I mean long, long-term, I'm looking at the heavenly perspective of this all and of our life, of our own personal journey that we have to go through, our relationship to end up in living with the kingdom, you know, with
yep.
God, and
yep.
to know that it's our holiness that we're responsible for. It's our heart that we're responsible for. And so to be able to lay down at night and know that we have done it well, with the boundaries that maybe we had to put in place or how we had had to speak to somebody in truth, even though it really hurt them or made them mad. But to be able to lay our head down at night and say, it's okay. You know, this is a tough journey, but God is with me.
Yes. Well, and for all the journeys of life, it comes down to that ultimately, that the Lord is with me. Lo, I am with you always. And that's what we all hold on to as Christians. And that at some point, we are no longer going to be suffering the way we suffer here on earth. But I think it's such a good perspective, Denise. One of the things that I really appreciate you saying is the fact that you're not going to help people lie, and that we need to face up to who we are as human beings created in the image of God. And that can be a long process. But I think it's such a wonderful thing that you are doing what you're doing for these families. I think increasingly you're going to be facing having more people come forward with this kind of gender dysphoria, because for some reason, you know, this just seems to be growing in our culture right now. Can you let people know, Denise, very quickly, how they can get in touch if they need help in their own families?
Yes, they can go to our website, which has all our contact information, and that's www.help4families.com. And just for folks to remember, you know, it's not easy to stand against the culture and what their messages are. It's hard to be a Christian today and to speak truth.
Yes, it is. And also the book, It Is Well With My Soul. Denise Schick with us, help4families.com. Check it out. Denise, thank you for being here. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
God bless. And we'll see you next time here on Janet Mefford Today. Thanks a lot for tuning in.